are presented today. We ended the part of the program which contains presentations, and we will have now a panel. I invite here Paul Aries, Brigitte Kromp. Adam there will replace Diane Geraci, which apologizes, but urgent personal thing called her in US. I invite you to come to the table, and you, the audience, are warmly invited for addressing your questions to the panelists today. Martin, you. Yep. When possible, please address your questions or the expertise you expect to be addressed for your question to the panelists. If not, I will roll the question to some of them that I think they could present a good answer to you. Don't be shy, there is no wrong question for today, so ask any questions you may have. Ask for more details if they are needed. Be provocative as well, and I hope we will make this 1 hour very interactive. Use Slido if you would like to keep you anonymously. Yeah, I'm tired a bit. And let's try to see how it works. Do we have any questions from the room at this moment? Yes?
At the moment, it looks that switching to open access just means publishing becomes very expensive. APCs cannot be paid by everyone in the world. So I find this a dilemma and a difficulty. If I look back in history, which is like 40 years ago, there were options at that time that publishers, that there were APCs, but if you were a graduate student or you came from a poor country like Switzerland, you had to pay less. What do you see in the future of this problem? And to me, this is a general problem and can be addressed to all of you.
Sorry, we tried to put Slido on the screen as well. Paul, would you like to start an answer?
Yes, so that's a very interesting question. What is the first going back to the points I made in my presentation this morning, where I tried to look at the future of scholarly publishing. And do you remember the slide I put up about the statement from the Leroux rectors, the 23 research-intensive universities in the League of European Research Universities? I had exactly that discussion with the rectors at one of the rectors' meetings, where we were looking at the future impact of open access and open science on our universities. I think for research-intensive universities who produce a lot of research, there is an enormously strong feeling that transformative agreements along the model that the Commission, well, the Science Europe, but really supported by the Commission, is suggesting in Plan S, will adversely affect the large research-intensive universities, because it will increase our costs to an extent that will not be bearable by our budgets. So there's the Leroux rector's view is that transformative agreements should cost universities no more than current subscription agreements do. So, as Adam has explained, in a transformative agreement, in a read and publish agreement, you don't have article processing charges and you don't have subscriptions, because those two forms of income have disappeared. And in their place, you have one payment that allows you to read everything and allows you to publish everything that you're producing. Now, for the lower universities, that has price cannot be more than the current subscription levels that we're paying, because the budget just isn't there to pay any more. So universities are reluctant to increase their costs, and I'm not convinced that publishers have quite got the message that there are no money trees in universities that will produce more money to pay more for a transformative deal. So what is the biggest threat to the move to open science? Well, as the Leru Rector's leadership statement says, it's the uncertainty about the impact of Plan S on universities and on the European publishing industry. So at the moment, I don't have an answer to how do we move from where we are now to where we want to be with any level of confidence that we have a proposition that will work, because for, as I say, the research-intensive universities, moving to transformative agreements isn't, at the moment, proving to be very easy. And so the UCL model that I outlined of developing alternative university-based publishing platforms where you can control your costs seems to us a much sounder way to move to 100% immediate open access. All the Leru members are absolutely supportive of open access, but not all the mechanisms for actually delivering it, because some of them we feel are not yet workable.
Brigitte, I will give it to Brigitte and then to
Anna. Okay. I'm head of consortia management at University of Vienna, and in the framework of the Austrian Academic Consortium, I'm called such like an open access expert. So I was involved in all negotiations we had with publishers for these transformative agreements. And in Austria, we have more than 10 transformative agreements now. So why do we make these agreements? It's because I totally agree with Professor Wheeler that it would be unaffordable if you stay with the subscription model and top it up with APCs coming from publication funds or elsewhere. So this is the reason that we do these transformative agreements, and we try to do it as cost neutral as possible. So what means cost neutral? I think this is this very difficult question, because rectors often understand cost neutral that we pay not more than we paid before. But if you look on a national level, that what we learned is that a lot of more money is already going to publishers outside of the library budgets. So our researchers and authors are already paying APCs, and the funding organizations are already paying APCs. So our cost neutral definition was we pay the subscription spending of the libraries plus what the funding organization was already paying for APCs. So on a national level, the money should be the same. And with this, most of our agreements are really within this framework of money. So to be honest, we do not need much more money than we paid before. And so this is the one side, so the total sum of money of a country going to a publisher. And I think that's not so hard to manage. What is really a hard question is, that is this reallocation of monies between the universities, because you have research intensive, let me say, publishing-intensive universities, like medical universities. Normally, medical universities publish most of in the university landscape. So how do we try to solve this problem? We do it within the consortium framework because we negotiate our agreements on a total span for the whole consortium. And then we try to calculate a new cost key between universities. And for example, we were successful with our Springer Compact deal. We are now in the second period of a Springer Compact. And for the first 3 years, we stayed with the old spending of the institutions. So every institution paid the same amount that they paid before. What we did now, when we start the second contract, we were able, because we had very good figures of publication output of every university. So we saw who are the winners and who are the losers. So winners, I would say, are the universities that could save monies, and maybe losers are the university, the research intensive, that had to invest more money. And because medical universities are very aware that they are publishing in a field where open access is very necessary in the meanwhile, so medicine, biomedicine, they know that there is no way beside of open access, and we came to an agreement that what we do now is that we have different increase rates that mean that universities who are not publishing so much do have a lower increase, yearly increase, than medical universities. And I had to promise to medical universities that the increase will not be higher than 10%, so they pay 9.5% now, I think. And this is manageable within a university budget. And after these 3 years, we will not have a fair or a, I don't know if it's fair, but it will not be a pay-as-you-publish spending, but we are moving in the right direction. So maybe we need another 3 years, but then someday we will be very near to the pay-as-you-publish publish model. And I think we have to understand that this transition period of reallocation of money will take some time.
How long?
Maybe 5 more years.
Thank you. So I suppose I might be able to provide a slightly more impartial view as an organisation that's just really trying to watch what happens in publishing and to provide researchers and people involved in the research process with tools to help them make the better decisions. I think the clue is it's somewhat in the name. These are transformative agreements. The system is changing to something else. That picture is not entirely clear at this point of time. And with most things, I think you will find a new natural equilibrium as that process happens. To talk specifically to the question you mentioned there about fees from poorer countries or those not able to afford. And I understand at the moment that a lot of publishers do offer waivers for these cases. Now, I assume what's going to become more interesting through these transformations is exactly who is going to pay. Out of the number of papers that are published, how many are collaborative? It's an increasing amount of collaboration internationally. Often with those in the global north and the global south who probably have access to quite different ranges of funding to support those publications. So that's going to, I think, put some pressure on. And the other thing I think will be that the institutions themselves or funders who are managing, if you like, the budget, but perhaps it's not an actual budget, but it's the cap on the number of papers that can be published, will then be forced to referee who is going to be allowed to publish. And that could be a risk. I don't know the details of these agreements as to whether or not that's there. So I think, yes, there will be changes and there will be unforeseen pressures and probably new mechanisms required to help mediate that process and happening. It won't be so straightforward.
Thank you. I totally agree that you know transformation. We're striving for something, but that can have unintended consequences. And you know what you said about waivers and things like that. And what Daniel mentioned is it's a genuine concern that you know by replacing one unfair model, like we are replacing one unfair model with another one. But you know you have to understand that there are people right now who are being locked out from reading the papers, and you know it. But you know when we are talking about these issues, we have to be very very we have to think about like not creating a system which would then you know lock them out from publishing. And waivers can be one way of helping these researchers. But also, like, if we would probably not think of the APC model in itself, so there are different ways of financing publishing. There are very very interesting, very innovative platforms such as SciPost, the Open Library of Humanities, where you can you know support a platform. It's owned by scientists, and there is no APC involved. Also in South America, the CLO initiative was running for 20 years for now, and they don't charge APCs as far as I know, but you know the publishing output is mainly open access because of that. So I think I kind of tend to think that APCs or APC price points are trying just to replicate the imbalances of the subscription system, and we must think beyond that. But you know, you cannot change the system entirely. So, but it would be easier to change from an open access publishing ecosystem to a more fair publishing ecosystem than from you know from subscriptions to a completely scholarly owned fair, you know, and transformative agreements are a way of achieving this.
Thank you. We have a question coming via Slido, and I think it is good to take it. Could you comment on the Sci-Hub? I will roll this question to each of you. Could you comment on the Sci-Hub issue regarding the publishing industry? And I would like to extend that question not only to Sci-Hub, but also to ResearchGate, and especially with the particular case of the ResearchGate movement into the syndication agreements, that, like the one that they are having it in place now with Springer, the syndication. So Sci-Hub, as originally stated, but also ResearchGate and the syndication agreements that they are having. Would you like to start, Brigitte?
Yeah, I don't know Sci-Hub issue. I mean, it's clear that Sci-Hub was really a big help in negotiating. But I always tell our students and also the scientific staff, really they come and they tell me, why do we have to pay subscriptions? Because I can find every article I need. And then I say, but I cannot put the information services for a big university with 90,000 students and 10,000 scientific staff and say, go in the darknet and look for articles. And how sustainable is Sci-Hub? So for me, Sci-Hub is not really a help for libraries or consortia in providing information, but it was a help in negotiating. So it's clear, and it's the same maybe with ResearchGate, but at the end the answer would be, and I'm really astonished that publisher didn't recognize this earlier, the Sci-Hub issue is finished when we are open access. So if I would be a publisher, I would try to transform as quickly as possible.
Yes, I'd agree with the last point that's made. Certainly, my library in the UK has never advocated the use of Sci-Hub by our researchers. What we have done rather is press for continuing movement towards full open access. And as soon as everything is fully available in open access, the Sci-Hub issue, however you define it, will disappear because it will not be required. So it seems to me our efforts are best placed into moving to 100% immediate open access as soon as possible. On the ResearchGate issue, I'm sorry, I don't have any particular view on it. It hasn't been an issue that I've had to deal with in UCL.
So I think Sci-Hub is a pretty good indicator of what the future will look like, because if we look back at music file sharing and Napster in the late 90s and the early noughties, that was a precursor to a bigger movement towards changing the subscription industry in music. And I think Sci-Hub is probably showing to some extent the way. One of the things I hear a lot about Sci-Hub is not that it's fantastic because not you can get all of the articles, but all you do is you just put the URL in and the DOI, and you've got a PDF, and that instant access element of it is also very appealing to people. ResearchGate, I'm not sure in terms of the potential copyright infringement aspect of it is particularly interesting, but what they may be well poised to do is to pick up on the, if we make the shift to open access, the need to be locked into a system to track your usage of the data will be the primary way to make revenue. And ResearchGate are setting themselves up for that. So they might be the leaders in that new world where all of the articles are available. So we'll see shifting focus towards people trying to track your activities and learn more about your data as any other form of interaction that you have on the web is now. So that will be worth thinking about in terms of how you want to align yourself, how comfortable you might be in making that data someone else's asset in the future.
Yeah, I completely agree that Sci-Hub is probably a symptom of a dysfunctional system, and you know, users are turning to that or to other platforms because of convenience, and you know, libraries and even publishers have to, like, they must learn about this that you know, building silos, hiding stuff behind paywalls is not in the best interest of the users, but also libraries have to think about that you know, like, accessing content is happening outside of the library collection, so it's like you can build your catalogs with very fascinated search options, but people will use the easy ones. You just put the UI, get the PDF, that's it. And we have to be conscious in you know, building these sort of platforms which help our users. And yeah, I completely agree with Brigitta that this would disappear. This problem would disappear in a fully open access setting.
Thank you. My name is Gabor Lanta. I'm from the University of Pécs and editor-in-chief of a scientific journal. I would like to strengthen this point that you said. Maybe you remember 2 or 3 years ago, there was a long study published in Science magazines on the users of Sci-Hub. And the take-home message there was that more than 50% of the users already have legal access to those articles. So they were not using Sci-Hub out of necessity. They were using Sci-Hub out of convenience. Okay, so there's something to be learned here for both publishers and libraries as well. Thank you.
Great comment. Thank you. We have another question coming from the same participant here, which I thank personally. I don't know who you are, Balint. Speaking about a matter of investment in a scholarly communication system, and he is pointing out that the money that already exists, probably considering also an increase due to annual, annual increase, inflation increase. Let's count on 5% on that. That money could not be enough for the increase that is happening in terms of output, which is doubling every 15 years. And as I took a habit of extending Balint's question with some of my comments, I would also think if what is your opinion about the responsibilities that libraries and public institutions have for taking up over the investment of this platform in making them more user-friendly or aligned with the technologies that we don't know yet and will probably be here with us in the near future and will demand a certain level of extra investment, not only keeping what exists, but invest in these new technologies. And I will roll these questions the reverse way from Adam, and you will pass it to the right.
Okay, actually, I'd like to be the last because then I had time to think about my answers. But thank you very much. I'm not sure if I understand it completely. So if we mean that moving from a subscription to a pay-as-you-publish model would not be feasible because of the number of citable items are increasing. So it's that's probably true.
The increase that is predicted because of inflation of 5%,
yes,
let's say, will be enough, the resources, financial resources, will be enough to cover all, not only the inflation, but also the new amount of articles that will be in 15 years from now.
Yeah, probably, because if you do more research, like you publish more because you do more research, and you do more research because you have more grant money, you have, you know, more support from taxpayers, from government. So it's like it's not happening in isolation. So if you finance research more, they will publish more, and there will be probably the money will follow the research intensive institutions. But you know, I still think that we would be better off in a pay-as-you-publish model than in a subscription model, because in a pay-as-you-publish model you pay for your own publication and read everything for free. In a subscription model you pay for everything everyone else's products, and then it's not very sustainable. Well,
so yeah, you anticipated what I was going to say, which is that cost is important. But we did some work earlier this year on effects of Plan S on publishers, on institutions, and things like that, just to sort of what the landscape is. And in looking at flipping scenarios, it was apparent that you had to consider what capacity was in place. So you can't just talk about, oh, you know, you're going to make this journal do this or otherwise, because suddenly they've got to review way more papers. And one of my colleagues who I was discussing with this with used to work in Sci-Rep, in Nature, and you know, he was talking about the problems you have there with very high volume journals who are, you know, the rate of increase of articles and being able to treat them properly with peer review is challenging. So I think there is a flip side to this discussion as well, which is we talk about the number of publications going up, and
I think there's maybe should be reflective as to, is that a good thing? Do we want that? And a lot of the time there's a, you know, increased scrutiny now on where people publish. There are more predatory journals, and a lot of studies now showing that even top universities are engaging in this kind of activity of slicing up publications to increase the number of outputs so you get more citations, so that your evaluation looks better, and all these sorts of things. And it might be an interesting resisting force to that, that actually if you have to pay to publish and you've got to justify every publication, maybe you really need to think about where you're going with that. Where are you selecting that publication to go? Because inevitably you will have to pay more for the better journals. And actually, what is the expected outcome of publishing there or in another venue, where another venue may get you more global exposure or coverage in an interesting region or cross-disciplinary readership or something? So there could be changes in how the in venues and perhaps more selectivity in where publication occurs, and a dampening, if you like, on this race to publish more and more, which is now increasingly difficult to read and discover and so forth. So I'm not to say that we publish too much, but we can always ask the question, is that what we actually want? What are the side effects of doing that? And, yeah, and to talk to the specifics of the financials, I don't know well enough the publishing industry to know that, but yeah, I could see that would be a concern.
I think from my own university's perspective, having our own publishing system, so UCL Press has a platform for research monographs, for textbooks, and also for journals. We have a mega journal platform that we launched in January this year, which I didn't have time to talk about, but which is our answer to the future of journal publishing. Rather than the university spend more and more on commercial publishers, be that payment for subscriptions or APCs, or the cost of a transformative agreement, we want to have a measured approach where we put any increase in spend on publishing activities, not so much on third-party commercial publishing, but investing in our own systems to build up capacity locally. This we can do for research monographs. We're starting, as I say, we're launching a textbook platform in the next 12 months, and I think we have capacity to deliver a really viable option for textbook publishing by investing in our own systems. The mega journal, the journals piece, is a bigger piece, and we would expect to be working in partnership with commercial providers in transformative agreements for the next 5 years, as we feel our way to developing the UCL publishing platform to create a substantial journals progress. So I would say it was a question in the journal space, a question of timing for the next 5 years, continue to fund both paths with commercial providers and investing and increasing capacity in our own publishing infrastructure, but with a view to our own publishing infrastructure being more predominant from year five onwards.
Yes, I don't know if it is necessary for the development of research that the number of articles is growing every year, so I really don't know the answer. But I think we all could agree that one of the main problems is really how research assessment and evaluation is done today. And that we all recognize that this is very, really a crucial point, shows that this discussion about new forms of research evaluation really starts on many points at the moment. We also had it today in some of the presentations. So I think that the community sees the problem, and my I'm really deeply convinced that all the libraries, all the consortia, all the publishers and who want to change the system could not be successful if we do not discuss research evaluation. But I'm hopefully that we started the discussion, and I think the discussion is going in the right way. I don't know. I think we can only hope that we find new ways of research evaluation that avoid this ever increasing number of articles. On the other hand, I totally agree with Adam. So we all want research and science to solve the big problems of the world, like climate crisis, cancer, Ebola. So I think research is necessary, and if we want, and especially in Europe, it's so necessary that we invest in research that I would say an increase of 2 or 3% per year, I think it's affordable for Europe. So I would not really be afraid of this.
Thank you very much for your encouraging way of put the light on this system. I also wish that in research we'll find much more attitudes and answers that usually starts with, not with I'm afraid that, whatever, but it will start with I hope that. We have a question from Gusun from Turkey, which is looking for your own long-term strategic plan for open science. And I would insist open science, not only open access, as we discussed a lot about open access. And I would like to add a personal note. I've noticed, and I think I'm not completely wrong, that many open science initiatives are supported via projects. So there was a project, there is a project, which has been granted with enough resources, and that developed some sort of ideas or infrastructure and so on. I'll take the question from Gusun, and maybe you can answer if the project-based investment in open science is suitable now, or some sort of other kind of investments, like program investment, other long-term investments. So what is your strategy, and how do you see this project investment for open science? I will start with Paul this time, as he has some roles with LERU, and he also advises the European Commission in a great deal.
Well, I can talk about, again, my own institution in UCL. So in my presentation, I identified the 8 areas of open science that have been pinpointed by the European Commission as areas, targets for development. We haven't in UCL followed the route of project funding to deliver services and infrastructure in those areas on the whole. We have a very successful open access repository, which is funded from the institutional research budget. The press is largely funded by the research budget. Our new research data service for storing and making open research data is also funded from the UCL research budget, and other activity advocacy and the work on our bibliometrics policy, which I talked about, which will hopefully go to the Senate for approval in the autumn, have been undertaken from existing resources, repurposing old posts in the library which were no longer required, and turning them into new posts. So, for example, we introduced RFID tagging across the whole of the library family. So all 17 libraries have now RFID tags for self-issue and self-return of books. And that meant I didn't need large issue desks staffed by people who were issuing books and stamping them on return because most of the traffic is now self-service. So those posts I was able to repurpose for Open Science posts within our Open Science activity. So it's been a mixture of investment from the research budget and from repurposing existing monies and existing posts as their remits became redundant in a digital world. And our plan for the next 12 months is to submit a bid to the institution for the creation of a virtual Open Science office to add another layer of administration and activity, which would be part of my Open Science responsibilities. But we'll bring all the existing Open Science activity together around the university into a virtual centre. But again, that will largely, I hope, be funded from the research budget rather than from project funding. So the secret, obviously, has been to get Open Science and open access embedded in the UCL research strategy and to see it as the future for doing research in one of the world's most successful research-intensive universities. If it isn't open access and it isn't linked to open science, then there's something wrong. And if you can get those statements embodied in your research strategy, then that will release money, at least in my institution, to enable you to deliver what it is you want to do in the open science landscape.
Yeah, but I cannot tell much about open science because I'm not so involved. But to answer the question, what is the long-term strategic plan for open science and transformative agreements? So it's my opinion that we will be very busy with negotiating transformative agreements in the next 5 years. And I will try to get as much as possible and to transform as many as possible articles because it's really my opinion that open access is a big advantage for science. But it's also my opinion that the kind of agreements will change during the next 5 years because already the agreements we have now in place are very different to the agreement which we started 3 or 4 years ago. So I think we have to find a new way of financing transformative agreements and open access concerning project money also. To be honest, I'm not so a fan of project money. It's helpful in the beginning, but you really have problems when the project ends. And if you go to the internet, you find a lot of websites of projects that started and after 3 years, and then you see results, and after 3 years, it's over. So I would really prefer that we get more money for research budgets, for library budgets, but real money and not only project money.
If you don't mind, Martin, I will take you to Adam.
But I can only echo Brigitte in a sense that I think that transformative agreements are here to stay for the next couple of years, and it would take a considerable amount of our time and efforts to you know maintain these. But also, I cannot really speak on behalf of ACE. I'm not the director, so I don't want to make false promises. But I can see the role of library consortia changing in the future, and you know, like we're trying to invest in open access, but I can see that for open science initiatives, like for example research data, open peer review, these sort of things. So for open science initiatives, the infrastructure that is making these happening is also crucial. And you know what Tiberius probably mentioned, like these project and these sort of things. You were probably thinking about sustainability of these projects because what Brigitte said, it's like it's 3 years and then it's done, and then you have like startups, you have very innovative companies who are working in the area of open science, but you know who are lacking the financial support, and then what they're gonna do? They're gonna sell out to Google or some other big companies. I don't want to mention. Once I think about right now, but you could see that with I don't know, with one science, for example, you could see that they have been bought by another company. So I think that probably libraries, consortia, research performing institutions will have to rethink how they support these infrastructures and to make them sustainable. But also then the question comes, and that's from the authorities, like, why should we pay for something which is open, which is for free? So it's like, that's a question, when how can you justify the costs of, you know, we were thinking about like supporting, and we are still thinking about supporting, let's say, Sherpa Romeo, but they operate a free API and we could use that for free. So how do we justify that we would like to support these initiatives? So that's a question of discussion with the funders.
Martin, what would be your advice?
I haven't too much to add because everyone else has, I think, summarized well. I think going back to the evaluation point is important, that we need the driving force to incentivize more open science. So having that as part of the evaluation process will help. The types of funding, I mean, there's so many. For example, in the UK, we've got a dual funding system. So we've got roughly half of the money coming from block grant and half coming from competitive. And those block grants are unhypothecated. You can spend that money on what you want. And I'm sure we'll see some universities becoming more invested in setting up for open science institutes or the programs that are needed to foster that kind of research, and will probably do very well for that. But of course, those academics will be taking money from the EU grants, they will be taking money from research councils, possibly from charities, if any of those exist. So there will be just more investment overall in infrastructure and a change in the mindset towards, you know, this is a worthwhile endeavor that will bring you wider impact than the just the scholarly reputation, if you like. And that's, I think, what a lot of people are looking towards now, and this will help us sort of combat a bit the scientific apathy that we see now, with people not wanting expert views and shutting down in debate because they don't understand science, which is fair enough, because, you know, a lot of the time it's in an ivory tower and people aren't participating. So yeah, it's a great opportunity, I think, for us to improve things.
I have a question for the panel, if no other question is coming from the room or via Slido. We discussed about open access. We tried to shift to open science, but it came a bit back to open access. Still, one idea have been floating up, that the change could not happen without changing the metrics. And I think that all the metrics, new responsible metrics that have been presented, they were still going around the scholarly communication. What would be your dearest, how would you have your most visionary, let's say, answer into new metrics that are measuring the collaborative spirit of a researcher, his inner motivation or her inner motivation of sharing the data, sharing the results, and also entering in partnership with others that doesn't exist around the corner in their city or in their field, especially for multidisciplinary. I know that the answer wouldn't be easy to be given, but what would be your most visionary answer into new metrics that are measuring, including the collaborative spirit of a researcher? Who wants to start?
Again, I can talk about my university. Every year we have a university-wide planning round where every faculty and every division, like mine, has to put in a strategic plan for the next 3 years, along with costings for any developments. So that will be the basis on which the bid for the Virtual Office for Open Science will go into the planning round in September. later this September when we submit our three-year plan. In answer to your question, Tiberius, I spent a good deal of the summer talking to our planning team in the university because they want to include a dashboard of metrics that will accompany each faculty or strategic plan to present the deans or directors of divisions or provosts like myself an overview of activity in their particular area over the last 12 months to act as the baseline for the strategic plan. And I was asked to advise on a number of open science metrics that we could produce for the dashboard. A number of things I have suggested. A number of things. I think the ones that will be taken up are really, because we are a research-intensive university, they will be about levels of compliance with open access mandates for publishing. They will be looking at research data activities and the sharing of research outputs, whether it's publication software or data sets in a number of repositories. We do measure collaborations via our institutional research office, and that's one of the metrics that we look at to look at the health of UCL research as a whole. Whether collaborations will actually make the dashboard, I'm not sure. It's a possibility. It's not in itself a measure of open science, but it is a measure of openness and transparent collaboration across different institutional and national boundaries. So the way we're trying to embed open science measurements in UCL is to embed them in this top-level strategic planning round that happens every year. We've never done this before. The planning team came to talk to me to ask about open science measures and open science metrics. So it will be an ongoing process over the next two or three years as I'm able to build up the number of open science metrics that we put in the dashboard that starts the planning process for our academic departments. But it's a step forward. I think to be asked for open science measures that will count towards evaluation as these strategic plans are being produced.
Sure, I agree with a lot of what Paul said then. I worked on a project with RAND and the Commission on the Open Science Monitor in 2015 or something. And it did seem a lot of the time to come back to a kind of compliance. It was in a lot of ways the best that you could do to measure whether or not data was made open and whether other aspects of it were visible. More broadly, I think the trend is it will shift towards increased scope of profiles around people in terms of how they can demonstrate their activities in academia. So we see that now with things like peer review recognition in terms of having visibility on speaking engagements and conference tracks that you attend and panels and all these sorts of things. And over time, a single point where you can bring together all of that information to get a wider view of what it means to be contributing. And that can be somehow a bit more democratic because not everyone produces lots of papers. Sometimes that credit should go to people who are perhaps more involved in an open science initiative or in a more teaching kind of capacity. That it's not that you want to measure them as being better or worse than someone who writes tons of textbooks or who writes all the Nature papers. It's just different. So hopefully we can, by providing more and more ways to see how people are who create their own unique identity, gives people more freedom and allows us to measure more,
there will be difficulties because a lot of the things that we will want to measure will not naturally lend themselves to numbers. And like I mentioned in my talk earlier, that with impact, a lot of the time it's just testimonial. This is text, and you can't attach a metric to that. It's very, very difficult. But there are other proxies. Unfortunately, a lot of time it actually comes down to money. So if you think about something like knowledge exchange, and you're trying to think about when how the university engages with business and does technology transfer and knowledge exchange, you might start looking at patents and citations from patents and things like that, and it gets very messy. But you can just look to see how much money of consultancy the university is taking from various companies, and that's a lot of the time a good indication. So there will be challenges. We may have to take very rough estimates sometimes, but overall, increasing the range of measurements, I think, will be the best course of action.
Sorry. this would be a dream come true to have like these multi-faceted profiles and you know with so many details about the activities of researchers and you know to evaluate them really on merit and like if when you asked what would be my ideal sort of evaluation connecting to open science but also like traditional things, I was thinking about something like this, like a dashboard with layers and profiles and involvement and collaboration and things like that. And but then you know there's also the perspective of the evaluators, so for whom you are creating these. So when you're being evaluated, that's great that you that most of your activities are captured in one system, and that would be really, really good. But then people who are looking at the evaluation, like you know the popularity of boiling down to only one metric, the impact factor or the age index, it was just because people wanted an easy answer to say that you know you have 5 and the other one is 7 and the 7 is better than 5. So evaluators probably, I don't know, this is my experience, they want easy answers and probably the right middle way of providing complex metrics in an easily digestible format would be an ideal outcome, in my opinion.
Brigida?
So I think we agree that it would be very complicated to measure the intrinsic motivation to collaboration of a researcher. But I want to give back a question to you. Is it clear that a researcher who has intrinsic motivation to collaboration is the better researcher? So I don't know, maybe we should also speak about this. But to come back to evaluation and I'm a little bit astonished about this impact factor bashing that takes place at the moment. Because we had a discussion with Professor Wieler yesterday in the evening, and the University of Vienna is not a special university, so we are middle class, don't cite me. But as long as I noticed and I'm involved, we never evaluate researchers only based on impact factor. We always do it in a mixture of bibliometric and peer review. And Professor Wieler said he also didn't notice that there is evaluation taking place only based on impact factor. And I really believe that universities or institutions that evaluate or look for new researchers and they do it only based on impact factor, they will not get the best researchers. So I don't know if it is really that big problem.
Well, I mentioned impact factors in my talk this morning. My university doesn't use impact factors for evaluation. And we don't use them for appointments either. We are so strict on this that I've trained our central human resources team who vet all the adverts for appointments that go out in the press to spot any mention of impact factors in the advert. And if the advert says you must have an impact factor of X, or you must have published in this or this journal in order to be considered suitable for this post, the advert is refused by the HR department and sent back to the head of department, and they get a note from me saying it has to be rewritten. And you have to drop any mention of impact factors, and you have to drop any names of journals or names of publishers that you put in the advert, because these are not open science principles, and we do not appoint or promote on that basis. That's the same message as Bernard Wantier's matrix of career evaluation that I talked about earlier. If every university in Europe adopted the same position, we could squeeze improper use of impact factors out of the landscape altogether. But it requires everybody to do it, not just one university like mine.
Can I share something on that? Yes.
I assume we're not being recorded. I'll just share. We are. That we do often get asked, and I won't name the country, but there's a country that we're working with at the moment in doing a national evaluation plan. And they, I'm not kidding, they asked me whether or not it would be a good metric to add up all of the impact factors for the journals that cited an article. I mean, this is still in the world a mindset that people have. And we have to, and I think I just wanted to reiterate what Paul said there, we have to work together. We all have to say, don't do that. That's always on our responsible use of metrics. You should not use a journal impact factor for assessing these sorts of things. It's just not appropriate. So yeah, thank you for supporting that view.
Thank you very much. With that being said, we try to conclude the day. Some messages that we can take up from this panel is that if you want to consider some advancement in open science, you have to include open science as part of your strategy in your institution. Another take up is that we all need to collaborate together in order to find the most suitable solution that will exist for today and probably a couple of next year until we find another one in implementing open science and transitions to open access and other metrics and indicators on that, and that one solution doesn't necessarily fit all. And in order to be successful in at least the transition to open access, you have to be persistent. And you have to believe on the plan, even if it takes 10 years, like Academia Ikeado, to reach some sort of success. I'm sure there are other conclusions that you may take individually with you. I personally regret that the topic of overlay journals didn't appear as a question for a conversation. Maybe it will appear next year. That stays on top of these green repositories. And I hope you all enjoyed the event today. I have to some sort of excuse that Professor Monok can't be here. He has he mentioned that he has an important meeting at the ministry to make some closing remarks. Thank you very much for participating. I hope we will meet again next year, and I hope you really enjoyed the day. You are very welcome to leave your comments on Slido, which will remain open throughout the day, and I will open an evaluation form instead of the survey that you currently have there. Thank you very much once again for participating here.